All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
All right, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I am the host today. And I'm really excited to be here because we've expanded. It's exciting. We're on the Patriot 1400 AM WDTK in Detroit, Michigan. And we want to thank everybody for being here on the program with us today. It's we're working with new technology, so hopefully everything will work out fairly smoothly here. I'm just going to say, as I just say, just keep talking, Dale. All right, well, I'll be doing that then. Again, just a reminder to all of you, my name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer, helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. And we are broadcasting today, well, from the bunker here in Ann Arbor and also from the station WAAM in Ann Arbor, 1600. Anyhow, before we get too far along into the program, I want to make sure that we thank our faithful sponsors. We couldn't be trying this without them. Number one is Legal Help for Veterans. Number two is the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDC, and the Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, VetBiz Central, and then finally our three local veteran service organizations. That is the American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and the Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310. The Charles S. Kettles Post here in all in Ann Arbor. We want to thank all of them for our support, and also many of you individuals out there who have been helping us out since Veterans Radio became a nonprofit organization. We are Veterans Radio America, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we want to thank all of you that have contributed individually to our mission. And of course, you all know that our mission is to tell the story of America's veterans in any way that we can. And we also want to make sure that you're aware that we help Americans veterans. We've got a number of groups that we're going to be talking with over the next year, which reminds me, we're going into our 18th year of telling America's story, and we'll see how that goes. I'm pretty excited to be on new stations, and I am very excited about the new year. So I want to wish everybody a happy new year from all of us here at Veterans Radio. Our first guest is one of the organizations that I heard about when we were first started Veterans Radio a long time ago, was an organization called the Veteran-Owned Business Roundtable. And the Veteran-Owned Business Roundtable is in Detroit, and it is its membership is comprised of all veteran-owned businesses, and they try to help each other out. Joining me on the line right now is Peter Vasquez. He is the executive director of the Veteran-Owned Business Roundtable, and he's also the CEO of Brand Echo Media Solutions. Peter, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Dale. Hope everybody can hear me now. glad to be here and glad to be on your show. I heard a lot of great things about it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. It's we're small but mighty. And as we continue moving along, I am very excited to have you on the program, Peter. We felt that with the idea of actually finally getting into the Detroit market, that it would just seem logical to have the Veteran-Owned Business Roundtable as our first guest. So,
I appreciate it.
Well, can you tell our audience what the roundtable is all about?
Yes, definitely. The Veteran-Owned Business Roundtable has been around since 2005. And we've been advocating for veteran businesses and ensuring that at the beginning, state of Michigan meets their, at that time, 3% that they had wanted to target veteran-owned businesses way back in 2005. Since then, we have grown nationally to where we work not only with the state of Michigan, but other government agencies and corporate members who also wish to do the same and meet a target spend with veteran-owned businesses. So we continue to provide programs that follow our pillars, which are to advocate, to educate, to mentor, to connect veteran businesses to the corporations and the government agencies that want to add veterans into their supply chain.
Well, it certainly is a worthwhile project, and I know I've been to a couple of your meetings over the years, and it's always a lot of really excellent business owners, I guess you could say, and across the spectrum. I mean, it's not just Army and Marines. It's every branch of the service. It's every age group. It seems like every conflict, veterans from all eras, and I think that's a great thing. And plus, it's someday when everybody can get together again, it's a great way to socialize and to meet up with other veterans who are, successful in business, and for those of us that are trying to become successful in business.
I think that due to the pandemic, I think that this year is going to be an even far greater year for all of us and anybody who is adopting the virtual way of connecting and communicating. And in this case, I think that it's a good thing for us. We've been planning this. We've been doing this since before the pandemic. So I feel that we're prepared now to be able to launch, continue launching our webinars, our Vets Connect program, our various programs that allow us to, one, that enable us to enact our pillars, but more importantly, to show results. And I think that's one of the things that our corporate members really, really do enjoy as a nonprofit organization, is that they know where their dollars are going to. They know that we're providing them results and connecting them with veteran-owned businesses and preparing them. Something as simple as, like you said, in one of those meetings, you saw the people, but every one of them had what they call, a one-page capability statement. They came prepared. Many, like myself, when I first joined this organization 6-7 years ago, it was just another veteran telling me, hey, are you a verified veteran-owned business? Like, why? Why would anybody give me a government contract? But when I discovered that this organization had these, not only these programs, but the members that are in them, the board of directors, it was something that I had to be part of. And I donated my time, and 6 years later, I'm now the executive director. And also have my own business, but my main job is to spread the news of what the VOBRT does for veterans and making sure that other veterans weren't like me and not knowing what the opportunities are, by knowing what's out there, knowing about the verification processes, the various verification processes that are out there, as one of your sponsors are, the NVBDC, the CVE, there's other ones that are sprouting up everywhere. But more importantly, besides, what to do with your verification, doesn't matter which one you have, it's what you do with it. And that's what we help veteran who discover the VOBRT in understanding, and make, more importantly, getting them connected to the opportunities that are out there.
Well, that's very true. I was looking at your website earlier, and you've got webinars, you've got, stories on there. You've got, it's a great and it's very user friendly website for veteran owned business owners out there who are not aware. And and as you pointed out, Peter, we're talking with Peter Vasquez, who's the executive director of the Veteran Owned Business Roundtable, that there are so many hoops it seems that people have to go through to not only to get a regular business off the ground, but to get a veteran-owned business off the ground, and to figure out how they can get the contracts with the various organizations, with the government. And there are so many corporations out there that really do want to work with veteran-owned businesses. This is something that we've found out over the years.
Yes, I mean, I think this, when it comes to working with other veterans, there's something of that instant trust you get when working with another veteran, when working with another veteran business. And it's something that, as myself, and I know many of our members, many of our sponsors, many of our partnering organizations feel, is that veterans have this mentality of, of getting the job done. And we like that, and we want to take them to the next level. But the first thing that we always tell veteran business owners who want to start their veteran-owned businesses, there's two reasons why you want to be a verified veteran-owned business. One, because you're proud that you are a veteran and you want to have a verified veteran-owned business. And two, you may not be able to do government contracting or corporate contracting, but still, people still want that verification to say, that's the last medal I'm going to get, and that is being verified veteran-owned business. And I did it. It's a task. Yes, it is, but it's well worth it.
Well, that's very true. And what we've talked about when we have talked with the NVBDC, that's the National Veterans Business Development Council, who's one of those certification organizations out there is to make sure that when somebody is promoting themselves as a veteran-owned business, that they actually are a veteran-owned business. And I think that that's what it sounds like what you are doing and how helpful you're being to all of the veterans in the area. And it sounds like this is not just in the Detroit area, of course. It sounds like it's a nationwide organization, correct?
Yes, yes, we are. We are a nationwide organization. We work with all the verification organizations. We work with the government agencies. And, of course, we're proud to say that we have 22 corporate members and organizations that support our mission and want to see us grow and to get other corporate members aligned with our mission and helping veterans out and to getting to the next step, you know. And that's, like I said, it's just, you know, I always tell veterans when I meet them, you know, anywhere, the first step is to commit to the cause, because otherwise it's just talk, you know. It's really important to commit to that first step of starting your business, and then we'll help you in getting the steps necessary to become a verified veteran-owned business. But first, let's get you committed to having a business. That's the first thing.
Well, that's very true. And you know, so many people, when they come out of their service, they're not really sure what they want to do, but they have ideas that they have been percolating in their brains for years. And it sounds like your organization is one of them that can finally, you know, put some structure to that idea and help them get going. So if I wanted to hook up with you guys, how would I go about doing that?
Well, the first thing I said is to commit, you know, and we commit, you will direct people to go to our website and to fill out our form, very similar to how I filled out that form that you guys wanted me to fill out when I went to be part of the show. And we have a very similar format. And then we review it. And then once we review it, our membership committee chair will contact a potential member and, you know, hear what they want to do, what they want to accomplish. And then, you know, that's the first thing is listening to what they want to do. It may not be in line with our organization's mission or direction. Some of them may be, and then we'll continue to the next step. But still, if they don't have all the answers, we want to direct them. So the first thing is committing to going to our website, filling out the information, and being ready for success.
Right. And that website is what?
VeteranRoundtable.org.
There we go. VeteranRoundtable.org. I really help you out. I encourage everybody who wants to start a business, especially if you're a veteran-owned business, to go there and check it out. I think that they're going to be able to help you. Peter, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio and for your patience. And hopefully I'll be talking with you again soon.
My pleasure. I look forward to attending again in the future. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Hey, this is Jennifer Nettles. Thousands of veterans are homeless and living on the streets of our nation tonight. Streets where they're being beaten, robbed, even killed. Let's take care of our own. Please join me in housing 1,000 veterans as fast as possible. Text VETS to 41444 and pledge any amount. They fought for us and now we fight for them. Veterans matter.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
So joining me on the line right now is a very good friend of Veterans Radio. And I was going back through our archives, and the earliest I think I talked with Dr. Grant was 2012. And that was when Bob Gould, one of my partners, contacted Dr. Grant, and we found out, wow, we've got a great resource here. And so we've been bringing Dr. Grant back every year at the beginning of each year, see if we can figure out what is going to happen next. So let me give you a little background on Dr. Rebecca Grant. She is the president of Iris Independent Research, which is a small business specializing in defense and aerospace research and consulting. She is a frequent speaker on air power and technology at venues ranging from active duty Air Force unit to Wall Street investors. You've seen her on the Smithsonian Channel, and just recently you probably saw her on Fox News. As I mentioned, she's been on Veterans Radio now going on 9 years, I guess it is now. And so I want to welcome her back. Dr. Grant, welcome back to Veterans Radio and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Dale, and Happy New Year to you. I am delighted to be back on Veterans Radio, and I'm excited about the huge number of topics we have to talk about as we look ahead in 2021.
It's hard to say 2021. I didn't think that was ever going to get here. It just seemed like last year just went on and on and on forever. But so here we are. We're at the end of an old year. We're going into a new year. Hopefully everything will go smoothly with the transition coming up in a couple of weeks, and we'll see how that goes. But let's talk about let's start off with the Biden administration and what you think might be their biggest roadblock in the immediate future.
Right. So we're just about 2 weeks away from the inaugural ceremony, which I've been to a few inaugurations, and probably you have as well. I think it's going to look pretty different this year. I don't reckon there's going to be anyone necessarily gathering on the Mall, but that will take place. And we already know a little bit about what Team Biden is planning for defense. A couple themes on policy. We know that Team Biden is very interested in emphasizing some new areas in national security, such as climate change. And he's got some big decisions to make, particularly as regards Iran. And I'm hoping we'll talk about Iran a little bit more later in the program. So the other theme we see, of course, is that President-elect Biden has announced several of his choices for his cabinet. The most important one, I think, for Veterans Radio listeners is the nomination for Secretary of Defense. That's gone to General Lloyd Austin, who is a fairly recently retired Army general, West Point grad. And interesting about Austin, he spent time as commander of Central Command, so he really is up on the latest of modern warfare, integration of air and ground and all that. Now, for Austin to be approved by the Senate, he not only needs to have that approval, but he's going to have to get a waiver from the Congress because he has been retired less than 10 years. You may remember that former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, retired Marine, got a waiver like that. So we're looking to see Austin. And as some of you may know, if he does become Secretary of Defense, he will be the first Black Secretary of Defense to serve.
Well, what do you know about him?
Well, you know, he's a really interesting man, and I'm going to credit the history department at West Point, which did a wonderful set of interviews with him spanning several hours. And one of the most interesting things about him, I think, is he said that he comes from a big family in the Thomasville, Georgia area. He says, you know, we are like the only Black Catholic family. When he was growing up, his dad was a postal worker and had been in the Army Air Corps. And General Austin grew up with four older sisters. And it's pretty funny, he said that he thought the best preparation for combat was growing up with four older sisters. So he was ready to take that on. He was an athlete, but he was also a scholar, and he ended up getting the appointment to West Point. And then he spent a lot of time in airborne. But he also has a little bit of time in heavy armor as well. And, you know, I think most of us came to know him when he was commander of U.S. Central Command back in the second term of the Obama administration. So he was there when the war with ISIS really spiked. Interestingly, he was the one who replaced Jim Mattis when Mattis left a little bit early from his tour of Central Command. So to Austin's credit, we have to do things like his ability to kind of rally the allies together, get a bit more air power in there in instances like the 2015 siege of Kobani, where they saved that border town. And he was the one who really had the task of ramping up the fight against ISIS. And then his tour came to an end before that conflict tapered down. But he was the one who kind of got both the European allies and the U.S. forces in there to really turn it into what became the third Iraq war. So he is, you know, they talk about how he has not spent, did not have a tour in the Pacific, for example. But, you know, rest assured, Austin really knows all about the conduct of modern warfare and how to, fend off the Russians and go after the bad guys on the ground. He knows it all.
Well, it sounds like it's always difficult when you're transitioning from one administration to another and finding out what's going on. But it sounds like he does have the experience and background, at least, at the beginning of the Biden administration, to give it a little bit of, dependability and hopefully a little continuity with what's been going on. We've had an interesting week here with the defense budget itself. And so can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's rare to see the defense budget making so much headline news. And of course, Dale, I don't know if you had the TV on New Year's, but there was the Senate in session on New Year's Day because they had to come back in to match the House in overriding President Trump's veto of the defense bill, one of them, the National Defense Authorization Act. And, you had to wonder, I'm sure you're wondering, why did he do it? Why did Trump veto the defense bill, right? It was kind of a surprise.
It was kind of a surprise. I mean, after reading and watching a few things, I finally understood some of the things that he was, concerned about. But I don't know sometimes. But they did do it. Why do you think that he, was it the base names or the liability, or what do you think were the reasons that he vetoed it?
Yeah, it turned out he had three reasons, and it turned out, it kind of seemed like out of left field, but in fact, he had put up a bunch of warning signals, and there was a method to what he did. And I think it kind of fell into two things. One was that this particular bill did put some restrictions on the commander-in-chief. Now, you got to understand the NDAA. This is the so Washington inside baseball, but just give me a second. It's the authorization bill. So it does things like it can authorize troop levels, but it can also authorize commissions and lots of other things. There is actually a completely separate bill called what we call the appropriations bill, and that runs in a different way. So as a result, the NDAA is always this bipartisan love fest. It's usually named for someone. In this case, it was named for outgoing House Armed Services Committee Max Thornberry. So for the president to veto it, it was really, really, really a big deal. Here's what he did not like in the bill. The bill has language that restricts his ability to take troops out of Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan, peace deal came in February, negotiations are going on, it's a right mess, of course. However, there is progress. And President Trump had added more troops to Afghanistan and had planned over the summer to look at drawing down from about 8,600 down to perhaps 4,500. Well, Representative Liz Cheney, who is Dick Cheney's daughter, Republican, got together with a Democrat from Colorado, and they put language into the bill literally restricting the commander-in-chief from going below 8,000 troops in Afghanistan. So it's like, whoa, wait, what? It's one thing for Congress not to approve sending forces, but this is Congress not allowing the president to bring forces home. I mean, holy moly, smack your head, right?
Right. I just didn't. It hurt, because I couldn't understand that. I mean, if we're going to restrict him from sending troops to places, we got to be able to let him take them out of places.
Right. And it uses this weird, you can't spend any money if the money is to withdraw the troops. And then they went and did the same thing for forces in Germany, okay, where the administration had been talking about drawing down U.S. forces based in Germany from, we have about 34,000, maybe going as low as 25,000. And I'm going to stress, no final decisions made on any of these. But there's same restrictive language in this bill to not permit U.S. forces to come home from Germany. And there's a really big irony with Germany, which is that in the last couple of years, the U.S. Army has built up quite a big base in Poland because that's the Eastern Front has moved east with the end of the Cold War, and that's the key front line tripwire force to challenge Russia. And so we have more forces in Poland, and, it's just this kind of thing that you ought to have the NATO Supreme Commander are U.S. General Todd Walters or you ought to have General McKenzie in Central Command saying, hey, here's where I need to move my forces around, and not having the House throw in this language and the Senate go for it. So President Trump didn't like that. The language passed, of course, in the override. So the irony, again, is this will tie President Biden's hands as well. You'll have to find a way around this. So that was one reason he vetoed it. The other was the issue of renaming Army bases that bear the names of Confederate generals, at one colonel and nine generals. But I'll come back to that in a second. The other reason he wanted to veto it was he wanted, President really wanted the Senate, and particularly Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, to add in some language on something called Section 230, which right. is a liability shield for big tech companies. And it's funny because the European countries don't have it, Canada doesn't have it, Japan doesn't have it, but we have this language from 1996 that treats them in a way that they're not liable for anything that's posted on the sites. Now, the funny thing about this was Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma said, you know, he hates 230 and wants it repealed. But he basically told President Trump, no way are you putting this in the defense bill. I'm not putting this in. And so those were the reasons that Trump did the veto. I think he knew there'd be an override. You know, the big tech one is really is separate, and you know, he talked about it being a national security issue, which could be true. But I think in a way, this was sort of one of his last acts going out, and he did certainly put a lot of attention on 230, and now the Senate is considering a separate bill to do 230 reform. That will depend, though, on the Republicans holding the House. Interesting story, though, on the Confederate base names, if you're ready to talk about that one.
Sure. I've been to a few of those.
You have, right. So names yes. like Benning, Bragg, right? You just, you know, we kind of roll these, you all that have served in the Army, you just sort of Hood, you know, A.P. Hill, Rucker, right?
Right.
My brother was in the Army in the Vietnam era, and he says, oh, Benning was just a name, you know, as far as I knew,
Wait.
Right?
I didn't know anything about the history of these bases. I mean, I just, you know, you weren't there long enough and you weren't really, in all honesty, that interested in the history of the base because you knew you were moving on quickly.
Are you kidding? Of course, right? So I'm really into military history.
I know.
I had to look these all up, you know, which I did when this first popped up as an issue over the summer. And you got to look them all up and who is who. Okay, everybody's sort of, I've driven by Fort A.P. Hill a lot, so I'm like, gosh, you know, I always wonder why they named it that. Anyway, wow. I mean, it turns out that the United States has Confederate-named items stuffed all over this country. And there is
yes.
one of my favorite examples is, you know, there's a Navy ship with a Confederate-tinged name. Do you know which one that one is?
No.
I knew I could get you on that one. So it's the USS Chancellorsville, named after the Civil War battle of 1863. And it is a, no kidding, Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser. She's out there now in the Western Pacific, toting around a bunch of missiles and missile defense stuff. Because all that class, you know, it's the Ticonderoga-class Revolutionary War battle, so they're all named for battles. And I think there's a Shiloh, which, of course, was a Union victory, but the Chancellorsville was a Confederate victory. Oh, my goodness gracious. So what we see is now, again, the big defense bill that the Senate did the veto override on New Year's Day has language to set up a commission. And this is so typical Washington. They're like, well, this is a real hot potato, so let's set up a commission. And they have about 3 years. They have to, you know, they had to start in 45 days, but they have a year to do their initial work. And, of course, $2 million for the commission. It's coming right out of the Army operating budget. So there's $2 million. It's not going to, you know, go to something else. But just kind of just a little primer on the big deal. It's popped up now and then. It came up in 2015. And the Obama administration's response was, no, we're not renaming these bases. And it was interesting, really, why they said, you know, forget it. And I'm actually going to read you the language that came from the Pentagon spokesman at the time, who was himself an Army brigadier. He said, quote, Every Army installation is named for a soldier who holds a place in our military history. Accordingly, these historic names represent individuals, not causes or ideologies. Okay, so that was then, but the issue got much, much bigger this summer after the death of George Floyd and everything that our nation went through and thought about at that time. Even a year ago, the Army said, nope, not going to do it, not going to rename anything, but now we are going to have this commission. Interesting point, just to give you a little primer on, as we all sort out what we think about this, you know, there's been kind of a charge that the Confederate names are traitors. And so you think, well, okay, these bases were set up in 1917, most of them, some in 1941, 1942. So why would we name a bunch of bases after traitors? Well, and the answer is they weren't traitors. The terms of the surrender set out by Lincoln and carried out by Grant exonerated everybody, remember? Everybody got paroled. Lee's army got sent home. They could keep their guns, they could keep their horses, they could keep, you know, everything. Right. And at Appomattox, General Grant, to whom I am not related, forbade any celebrations. He said there won't be any hoopla, there won't be any, you know, you're going to be quiet, you're going to observe this with silence. And it was a very, you know, very, very different thing. All through the war, Lincoln was constantly looking for a way to end the war and bring them back to be one country. So they weren't named after traitors because the technical terms of surrender exonerated everyone. You know, the only traitors were Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Texas, the states that seceded. So it's really, you know, it's really a sort of a difficult situation, and the practical details are staggering. I mean, I mentioned about the Chancellorsville, but it turns out that the National Park Service also has a lot of battlefields that have, you know, a Confederate statue or memorials here and there. The VA has the cemeteries, and a bunch of those have Confederate statues. And then, of course, they're the bases. So, you know, it's really an interesting question. And I think, you know, President Trump's point was that there's a history now of the millions who have been through those bases and who served there, and it's sort of, you know, the history of the 82nd, you know, Airborne at Fort Bragg means more than whoever General Braxton Bragg was. So,
well,
I
agree with that. I mean, right. I can't imagine Fort Rucker being anything but, you know, Mother Rucker.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody refers to it as. And I hate to have to, you know, come up with a new slogan and all the other things that go along with that. I think it's, you know, it's rewriting history, and I don't think it's necessary to do that. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant here on Veterans Radio, and we want to encourage you, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can by giving us a call at 734-822-1600. We're going to be taking a break, so I'm going to ask you to hold on for just a second, Rebecca. This week's Medal of Honor. This week's Medal of Honor segment is brought to you by Eric Fretz and the Fretz Family Foundation in honor of Major Kevin Nav, United States Marine Corps. If you'd like to sponsor a Medal of Honor segment on Veterans Radio, you can just go to veteransradio.net and click on sponsor. And we would love to have you continue this new tradition that we're doing of having people sponsor our Medal of Honor segment each week. So we will be back in just a moment with Dr. Rebecca Grant, ask her your questions. We've got a whole bunch more topics to talk about. So you're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Submarine Commander Richard O. Kane chose to face the enemy on the surface despite overwhelming odds. Details after this. O'Kane served as the commanding officer of the USS Tang, operating against two enemy Japanese convoys on the 23rd and 24th of October 1944 during her fifth and last war patrol. boldly maneuvering on the surface into the midst of a heavily escorted convoy, O'Kane stood in the hail of bullets and shells from all directions to launch smashing hits on three tankers. Cooley swung his ship to fire at a freighter, and in a split-second decision, shot out of the path of an onrushing transport, missing it by inches. Boxed in by blazing tankers, a freighter, transport, and several destroyers, he blasted two of the targets with his remaining torpedoes, and with pyrotechnics bursting on all sides, cleared the area. 24 hours later, he again made contact with a heavily escorted convoy, steaming to support the Leyte campaign with reinforcements and supplies and with cratered planes piled high on each unit. In defiance of the enemy's relentless fire, he closed on the ships and in quick succession sent two torpedoes each into the first and second transports and an adjacent tanker, finding his mark with each torpedo in a series of violent explosions at less than 1,000-yard range. With ships bearing down from all sides, he charged the enemy at high speed, exploding the tanker in a burst of flame, smashing the transport dead in the water, and blasting the destroyer with a mighty roar which rocked the tank from stem to stern. O'Kane expended his last two torpedoes into the remnants of a once-powerful convoy before his own ship went down. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Lieutenant Joel Boone, a Navy doctor, entered an open field under heavy fire to give aid to wounded Marines. Details after this. Boone, while serving with the 6th Regiment U.S. Marines, left the shelter of a ravine and went forward onto an open field. There was no protection, and despite the extreme enemy fire of all calibers, Boone moved through a heavy mist of gas and applied dressings and first aid to wounded Marines. When the dressings and supplies had been exhausted, he went through a heavy barrage of large caliber shells, both high explosive and gas, to replenish these supplies. He returned quickly with additional supplies and administered them in saving the lives of the wounded. Boone made a second trip, under the same conditions and for the same purpose, later that day.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking to our favorite foreign affairs, foreign policy expert, Dr. Rebecca Grant. And I don't want to run out of time today, Dr. Grant, so let's go right to Iran and tell us what's going on over there.
Iran, well, you know, we're at the one-year marker following the death of Major General Qasem Soleimani, who was their number one terrorist Quds Force commander. Iran made a lot of rattly noises about revenge options, and I will tell you what the Pentagon has said tells me that they are really taking this seriously and making sure our forces in the Middle East region are ready for anything that might happen. You know, sometimes they say, well, we're just hearing chatter, but then this time the Pentagon has said, you know, we have some fairly substantive threat signals. So, you know, they're making sure that our forces, particularly those in Iraq, are safe and ready for anything that might happen. You know, the trouble is with Iran, things have really changed. I mean, they have shown over the last 2 years in particular that they have some pretty sophisticated revenge options. Just look at the September 2019 strike on the Saudi oil fields. By the way, those oil fields are pretty hit occasionally still by Yemeni Houthi rebels that are supported by Iran. Then, of course, the January 8th attack on the U.S. forces in Iraq that was, I mean, you know, just miraculous, but really well done on the ground that that no one was killed in that strike. They did have a bit of advanced warning. They were able to move some people to bunkers, but the security forces there said, you know, they had UAVs up around the airfield, and they were very concerned that if there was, after the incoming missile strike, there might be ground operations around the airbase. So the crews manning the UAVs, the unmanned planes, well, these are ground crews, right? Their commander told them, hey, look, there is going to be, these missiles are going to come in, it is going to be terrible, and you're going to have to jump right back up and keep those drones up to watch our perimeter. They did that. Several of them had pretty bad concussions, but they were really, really heroic in what they did. And then just 2 weeks ago, there was a typical Iran-backed attack, which was about 20 rockets hit the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad. And this is what Soleimani was so good at. He has set up the Iraqi militias within Iraq that are backed by Iran that are Shiite and like to set up a rocket in the parking lot and strike into the green zone. They've killed a number of people doing that over the years. Luckily, no casualties this time on December 20th, but, you know, Iran has shown that they're really willing to do these missile strikes. Now, question for Iran, I mean, if they, what they want is they want sanctions relief. The Trump administration put the maximum pressure sanctions on, and they're very effective financial sanctions that have also limited Europe's ability to trade with Iran. There's a little window for food and medical relief, but other than that, it's really hard to do business with Iran. Iran wants that off, and, you know, their choices, if they try to strike back in revenge for Soleimani, you know, then Team Biden is going to know just how bad they really are. And, of course, Iran is way over their Iran deal limits on enriching uranium and on the amount they store it on their heavy water activity. So they are very much in violation of the Iran deal and hoping for some sanctions relief, I think, from the new administration, but I suspect not likely to get that from President Biden.
I hope not. I mean, it's just that whole area just never seems to end. It never seems to end. We've still got Afghanistan, as you mentioned earlier on, you know, trying to set up a peace deal there. Do you see any hope for that?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's hard to be, wow, what a long ongoing operation that has been. But the deal that was concluded with the Taliban was done by our U.S. Special Representative, who is an American but Afghani-born, Ambassador Zameh Khalilzad. He spent over a year working that out with everyone, and the deal is in place. And probably the most encouraging sign is that it required what they call the intra-Afghan talks to begin, and that is talks between Taliban and their representatives and the elected Afghan government. Those are underway. They actually took a three-week break over Christmas. And there has been sporadic violence. Some of the violence is caused by ISIS outfits that operate in Afghanistan, and some of it, frankly, is also caused by Iran. So really, really difficult, but it's a very good sign that the intra-Afghan talks have begun. NATO has long been our partner in that region in the big coalition. They've committed to keep forces in place at least through 2024. So we'll have some forces there, but I do think that there is a good prospect of doing some drawdown. And, you know, this is the piece that we have to stick with. For one thing, Afghanistan's government wants to do it, and a lot of the Afghan government reps are people who have lost family members or been victims of assassination attempts themselves. You know, they know how bad things are with the Taliban, and if they want to make peace with the Taliban, hey, we've got to follow suit and say, yes, let's do it. And my heavens, it is certainly time to bring more of our U.S. forces home, knowing that we can leave surveillance, air power in place and have special ops and everything ready to go back in anytime we need to. The main hope, of course, rests with having worked to train up Afghanistan's army, their police forces and their Air Force, and that is the plan for Afghanistan's security going forward, and I think we need to stick with it and make it work.
One would hope so. One would certainly hope so. I did want to go to a question that we got, and I sent this along to you. We got a contact information from Mike McCann. He was curious about the aircraft that was used, that the Air Force was using during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, this was a wonderful yes. question, and it led me back to something I hadn't thought about in such a long time. Yeah, he was talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, right? And
yes.
and the response, and we think about the U-2s that were flying over, one of which was shot down, and all that, but and the world being on just absolutely on tenterhooks to see what this confrontation would involve, the Navy involved, but big role for the Air Force. And he talked about being at Homestead Air Force Base at that time in Florida, which was a huge bomber base with B-47s. But during the crisis, they brought in over 150 F-100 Super Sabre fighters.
There we go. I knew you'd find the answer.
That's right. They brought them in from the 31st Fighter Wing, which is still over in Italy, 4th TAC Fighter Wing. They stuffed these aircraft in there, and they all had targets in Cuba, which was about 90 miles away. If they needed to do it, the Super Sabres were ready to go plaster Cuba and take out the, you know, help take out the sites where the Soviet Union was trying to put their intermediate range missiles, putting ICBMs or in Cuba. Oh my goodness, it was a terrible crisis. And interesting thing about this was, of course, this was like a rapid response deployment here in the United States, but it kind of prefigured what we saw, whether in the linebacker offensive of 1972, spring of 72, in bringing air power back in theater, and of course, it prefigured something that happened just about 30 years ago today, and that was Operation Desert Storm. Started January 17th, 1991. I'm sure you have a lot of Persian Gulf War veterans in the audience, and that remembering back to the rapid deployment of U.S. fighters from Langley and other bases, and then, of course, the huge deployments and that masterful campaign that took place in January and February of 91.
It seems like, you know, there are so many crises out there that we forget about them sometimes. And I really want to thank the question that came in about the jets that were used during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I want to talk about the elephant in the room, and that's China.
Oh, are they ever. And here's, to me, kind of the time bomb with China. That is, they have been very aggressive towards Taiwan over the last several months. On December 21st, they ran one of their aircraft carriers. Hey, think about that. We're saying one of China's aircraft carriers, the Shandong, they ran it through the Taiwan Strait. They have really, really put a lot of pressure through air flights and the naval transit and all this on China. And I think this is going to be one of Team Biden's issues that they have to confront almost right away, and that is, how do you deter China from making a move on Taiwan? You know, we used to have a lot of U.S. forces on Taiwan, and I think it might be no bad thing to consider some rotational training forces there. I wouldn't mind seeing a few Marines there, perhaps some helicopters. The Trump administration greenlighted far more defensive arms sales to Taiwan. I think we need to continue that, but this is a situation that is really ripe for deterrence with U.S. military forces, and something I think that Team Biden will really have to think about, particularly in light of China's really unchecked aggressive activity towards Hong Kong, and of course their colonization of the little reeflets in the South China Seas. We need to draw the line, and I think Taiwan might be the right place to do that.
I couldn't agree more. We haven't heard much from North Korea recently. Anything on the horizon with them?
Very, very, very quiet. I will say one really good thing, and this may be the legacy of the Trump administration in North Korea, still no long-range missile tests. They occasionally fire off short-range things, but they have not, since 2017, done any long-range missile tests. And that means they are still at least a dozen tests short of having a reliable arsenal capable of striking the U.S., and that's a good thing. The other good thing, tensions really are lower. Things aren't as good as they were 18 months ago, but there is definitely a sense that we hear from our commanders in the Pacific that tensions with North Korea are a lot lower. And I think those two things, maybe that's what we get out of this phase of North Korea diplomacy, but they're both really, really solid gains. No long-range missile tests and lowered tensions.
Where do you see the next hot spot? Do you think there's something that somebody's going to, that we haven't heard of yet, or is it going to be one of our traditional enemies, I guess you could say?
Well, there's every chance it could be space. Space Force passed its first birthday, and I think, you know, we're more concerned than ever to make sure that, sort of as with Taiwan, that we don't see either China or Russia get too aggressive in space. Russia did 3 satellite killer tests back in 2020, that's bad. So yeah, we're going to have to keep our eyes there. And China has a probe landing on Mars in the next couple months. They'll arrive. They launched in July. They have a probe arriving in Mars orbit in February. So the next hotspot could well be space.
Well, the Dr. Rebecca Grant is our resident expert on a lot of different things. My wife says you should run for president. So I want to thank you very much for being on our program again and enlightening our audience and enlightening me especially. You're the one that I go to find out what's actually going on in the world. So I want to thank you very much, and we'll look forward to having you on again probably in a couple of months to see how Biden's doing.
Thank you. I'd love to. And I urge any of your veteran listeners who have an opinion one way or the other on the base names, go ahead and write your congressman. If you think it's a good idea to rename them, go say so. If you think it's not, say so. They really do listen to public opinion from veterans. Pleasure to be on with you, Dale. Thank you.
They do. Thank you, Dr. Grant, very much. We've come up to an end of our program today, and I want to remind our listeners, if you have any comments about today's program, please leave them on our website. We are also seeking a support from all of you out there to help us keep our website, social media, and programs going. So if you want to, you can go to our Buddy Money button on our website, veteransradio.net, and make a small donation. We'd be very grateful. Check out our merchandise on there. We really thank you all very, very much for your support over the years and going into the future, as they say. We want to thank WDTK Radio today. We'll be back next week. And until then, you are dismissed. Not yet. We ran a little short this Sunday. We had some technical issues. So we're going to add a song to the end of today's program by Michael J. Martin. And Michael J. Martin was a Vietnam veteran. He was a veteran troubadour known throughout the Vietnam veteran community. And this song is When Your Daddy Comes Home. At the end of that, then you truly are dismissed.
When your daddy comes home, honey, we're gonna throw our arms around him. Our whole family will surround him and hold him tight. Then we'll bring him on home, honey, and show the picture you drew for him. And say a prayer and thank the Lord he's home alive. But it's gonna take time to heal. And we have to keep in mind what he's been through. Just believe it will be fine someday soon. When your daddy comes home. when your daddy comes home, honey. He may want to be alone, he may go off on his own. Sometimes what we need to know, honey, is that we've done nothing wrong. It's just a war that he has known still on his mind. And it's gonna take time to heal. Have to keep in mind what he's been through. Just believe it will be fine someday soon. When your daddy comes home. Your daddy comes home, honey. We're gonna throw our arms around him. Our whole family will surround him and hold him tight. When your daddy comes home.